Secrets and Lies. I like to think of myself as a relatively honest person. It's usually just easier to be honest. However, the complexity of parenting leads you to lie to your children. Honestly, I'm ashamed how often I lie to my children. Cute sentence, right? Maybe they aren't all lies. I suppose some of it is just dishonesty. Some of it's acting. Being a parent to a young child is being an actor. I've been lucky enough to act in movies, TV, and on Broadway, but I believe my finest acting moments have been with my children. Parents of young children are always acting. You act excited to read a story for the 500th time. You act impressed someone went to the bathroom on the toilet. The excitement I show to some of my children's scribbles should get me a Golden Globe nomination. Of course, this parental acting is a necessary form of encouragement. Most parental lies just seem pointless and almost abusive. A man from the North Pole who slides down the chimney and brings presents seems so much more believable than a bunny that hides eggs. Somehow little kids believe all this stuff. It's pathetic, really, how gullible they are. I understand that we want them to experience some of the magic of childhood before they are forced to grow up and face the harsh realities of gas bills and root canals, but really, some of these frauds that we purposely perpetuate are just unnecessary. A fairy that brings you money for your tooth? Who started that one? And why do we keep it going? We are totally pressured into telling this lie because we are terrified if we are the only honest parents who say, "Look, you lost a tooth, congratulations, enjoy looking like a hillbilly, here's a dollar." We might be unconsciously depriving our children of some yet unknown but really important stage of development, and we won't find out until it's too late and we find a dead hamster in their backpack. By the way, could we all agree on the cash value of a tooth? I remember finding a shiny quarter under my pillow for my first tooth and being excited that I could buy a candy bar. I went to school for finance. I understand basic economics. When Maury lost her first tooth, I adjusted for inflation. According to my calculation, $1 would be perfect. Maury was thrilled in the morning when she lifted her pillow to see George Washington frowning up at her. However, when she returned from school that afternoon, she was devastated. What had happened? Through her tears, Maury choked out, "The tooth fairy hates my tooth. Why did Nellie get $20 for her tooth?" Because Nellie's parents didn't have change, that's why. Somehow we all got the memo that you can no longer put new babies to sleep on their stomach, but no one can agree on the value of a tooth. Come on, people. Eventually, children start questioning these ridiculous lies. Maury, now 8, has begun to wonder how Santa can reach every house in the world by flying reindeer. I suppose soon Maury will start lying to Jeannie and me about believing in Santa in a couple years after she stops. That's what I did. I didn't want to ruin it for my parents, and also I didn't want to risk dissuading them from getting me presents. I'm not proud of the lies I tell my children. Some are truly selfish and for the wrong reason. "Honey, you wouldn't want a bite of Daddy's cheeseburger. It's spicy." I don't feel guilty when I deny eating my kids' after-school snacks. I feel guilty telling them that their mom did. Of course, no parent sets out to lie to his or her children. I never did. Then again, I never thought I would let my 3-year-old watch TV or chew tobacco. Sometimes we have to lie about stuff to scare them out of hurting themselves. "Don't play with firecrackers. My friend blew his hand off with a firecracker." In a few years, they'll learn that everyone's father had a friend who blew his hand off with a firecracker. We will be revealed as the liars we are, and to retaliate against our hypocrisy, our children will grow up and lie to their children. Every parent lies to their kid, and that is a fact. We don't want to, but we do. The biggest lie we usually tell them is when we threaten our children not to lie. "Don't lie, or I'll tell Santa." A critical analysis of children's literature. Everyone knows you're supposed to read to your children. Well, that's what I hear when I have my kids watch Sesame Street so I can waste time on the internet. Read to your children. Interestingly enough, when you hear "read to your children" on Sesame Street, they never say, "Did you hear me? Do not watch Sesame Street. Turn off the TV and read that kid a book." We know we're supposed to read to our kids. What they don't tell us is that we will be reading the same books over and over and over again. Around the 10th time reading some of these books to your kids, you begin to develop some really strong opinions and questions about them. The Very Hungry Caterpillar. I'm sure I'm not the only one who is concerned that maybe the main character has an eating disorder. Hey, I identify. Five Little Monkeys. I think after the second little monkey jumped off the bed and bumped its head, the doctor who the mama called would have been tempted to call children's services. Yet the doctor's advice remained, no more monkeys jumping on the bed? Really? Didn't that doctor take an oath at some point? I smell a lucrative malpractice suit. The Giving Tree. A favorite, but really, how depressing. Whenever I read this to my children, I always think, I'm the tree, now I'm the stump. What's the lesson here? Take everything from your parents until they have nothing left, and then move back in when you've squandered it all, and you're an old loser, and your parents will let you crash on their stump? Caps for sale. Another favorite, but why would anyone want to buy a cap that someone is already wearing on his head? If there are monkeys in a tree, where's this peddler selling these hats? Where are the people? I've read this book 100 times. He's not going to sell any of those caps. He should just let the monkeys keep them. They're the only ones that want them anyway. Goldilocks and the Three Bears. No one ever questions why the Papa Bear and Mama Bear slept in separate beds. What was going on in that marriage? More backstory needed. The Wheels on the Bus. I'm not sure if The Wheels on the Bus started as a book, as a song, or as a torture technique, but it sounds like it was a pretty annoying bus ride. Goodnight, Moon. He has to say goodnight to everything in the room? That kid was obviously just procrastinating. How manipulative. Harold and the Purple Crayon. Great book, but where do I send Crockett Johnson the bill for cleaning my walls? Glad it wasn't Harold and the Purple Book of Matches. The Runaway Bunny. Who wouldn't want to run away from that mother? Talk about overbearing. Go, Dog, Go. Gets heavy with the Do You Like My Hat subplot, but is really, really easy to read. Totally my pace. The message is clear, concise, and important. Everyone wants to go to a party in a tree. It's true. All Dr. Seuss books. Is it possible to read a Dr. Seuss book and not sound a little drunk? This brings up another aspect of reading to your children. You're not just reading, you are performing, or at least you're supposed to be. Jeannie has well-defined characters, each with a complex history. I suffer by comparison. I've had one of my kids tell me to read with less boring. Every parent has his or her favorite children's book. They often sound passionate about the book. I just love Babar. It's not that Babar is so good. It's just that most children's books are so bad. Many children's books don't even feel like first drafts. They feel like someone has sent the text of most children's books via Morse code. Tom has a ball. Cindy has a doll. Tom and Cindy are friends. End of book. Stop. Don't get me wrong. I have great memories of children's books, and my reading level has not advanced far beyond them. It's just when I pick up one of my old favorites, I'm sorry, but it never holds up. For example, my favorite book as a child was Harry the Dirty Dog. The story goes like this. Harry was a white dog with dark spots who didn't like to take baths. He ran away and got very dirty, becoming a black dog with white spots. Eventually, he gets hungry and tired and wants to go home. Upon his return, his family doesn't recognize him because of his color change until he gets a bath and they realize it is Harry. Really? They don't recognize a dog that outside of the color looks identical to their dog, does the same tricks, and is obviously dirty? I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. How dumb do they think I am? And I'm pretty dumb. To be fair, some of them hold up. The little engine that could, I still never think he's going to make it up the mountain. But I'm always pleasantly surprised when he does. It's kind of the Rocky of children's books. Still waiting for the sequel. The Little Engine That Sought Revenge, Part 2. No further questions. I often wonder what my children really think of me. I can be silly and playful, but at times I do have to be a bad, mean daddy. For example, I rarely give them one more chance. If they are not getting dessert, they are not getting dessert. I have actually turned the car around. I try not to be mean, just strict. And they let me know, from the moment my children learned to speak, I've heard many different versions of, "You are a bad, mean daddy," in reaction to my strict style. Just when I start to worry about being remembered as a tyrannical figure, my children remind me in their unique style of communication that I am not, in their eyes, the dictator that I think I am. Negotiation seems to be the predominant form of communication in my daily dealing with my children. "Dad, if I take a bath, can I watch a movie? What do I get if I clear the table?" I always seem to be on the losing end of arbitration. I constantly feel like I'm bartering with my children. I suppose this is part of the parent-child dynamic. I'm sure that throughout the centuries, sons and daughters have bartered with their fathers and mothers. I wonder if Jesus negotiated with God about some of the stuff he had to go through. "Jesus, you are dying on the cross for all mankind. Well, if I do that, can everyone have Sundays off?" Notice the response is always a question. The question is the primary form of communication for little kids. They learn to speak and the questions commence. Anyone with kids knows about the questions. "Daddy, what are you doing? Daddy, why are you doing that? Daddy, how long are you going to be doing that? Daddy, why are you putting on headphones and having a beer for breakfast?" I sometimes believe preschool was created by a parent who needed a reprieve from the incessant questions of a three-year-old. Of course, these never-ending questions require answers you are not qualified to give. How do you answer, "Daddy, why are you a stand-up chameleon?" Or, "Why don't dogs get the chicken pops?" When my son Jack was 4, he pointed to a car antenna and said, "Look, Daddy, stick." I clarified, "Actually, that's an antenna." Jack then asked, "What's an antenna?" After realizing I had no idea how an antenna worked, I explained, "It's a stick, a metal stick. You nailed it, buddy." Even all their so-called statements will contain a question in the subtext. "I'm hungry" is really, "Why don't you feed me?" "I have to go to the bathroom" is, "Can you clean up this pee on the floor?" Another endless form of questioning is under the "Are we there yet?" category. If you ever mention something fun that you are going to do with your young children, and there is any time that will elapse between the very moment you bring it up and when you are actually doing the fun thing, you will be barraged with questions during the entire time period. If you tell them that you might go to Disney at some point in the coming year, you have opened a Pandora's box. "Are we going to Disney now? How long till we go to Disney? Is it time to go to Disney yet? How many hours till Disney? What does 3 months mean? Is it 3 months yet?" It is crucial that you withhold as much information as you can about this fun future event until 30 seconds before you arrive, or 10 seconds, depending on your question tolerance. Out of necessity, all parents of little kids actively attempt to curb the unnecessary question by speaking in a parental code to each other. Parents will write notes, whisper, or spell things in front of their children. Once Jeannie said, "Don't tell anyone about the ICECREAM. I remember thinking, "Who's in the emergency room, and why do I want a dilly bar?" Of course, there are many things you shouldn't say or do in front of a three-year-old. Everyone knows you're not supposed to argue or curse in front of young children. What you'll learn is the only time a parent really needs to argue or curse is when they are with young children. If you don't believe me, wait until your kid spills a drink on your computer. We tried a cursing mug, where if Jeannie or I cursed, we'd have to put money in the mug. 2 hours later, our son threw a ball and accidentally broke the mug. And yes, I cursed when he broke it. Even more important than not arguing or cursing, a parent should never say the words "ice cream" in front of young children. Little kids only hear a commitment. "Yeah, I'll have ice cream." You can't explain to them, "Daddy's just saying the words ice cream. It doesn't mean we're going to have it right now. Do you understand?" They will, of course, nod and say, "I'll have chocolate." I'm not exaggerating about saying ice cream in front of a three-year-old. Test my theory at your own peril. You don't believe me? Go on, try it. I dare you. Have you done it yet? See? Told you. Now don't you wish you had followed my advice? Wait, you didn't really do it, did you? I feel like I can't trust you anymore. Bring in the noise. The definition of children should be young humans constantly making noise. Whoever first coined the phrase the pitter-patter of tiny feet to describe the noise that young children make was way off. That is like confusing a stick with a forest. If children equal noise, then having 5 children is like living on a construction site. Noise from our children is a constant in our house. Silence is startling to me at this point. Once a moment of silence actually woke me up. What is that? Is a tsunami about to hit? Like an orchestra that is always rehearsing, my children provide a wide variety of sounds. There should be a children's song. If you're happy and you know it, keep it to yourself and let your dad watch the football game. There's crying, humming, tapping, and that's just when they're asleep. My son Jack actually makes noises of video games in his sleep. Beep, beep, boop, boop, ba-doo, 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 ba-doo. The scary thing is we don't have a PlayStation, an Xbox, or a Wii, although he asks for one daily. He is actually dreaming about playing video games. Well, we all can dream. The good news is that the night noises are barely audible from another room. They just mix in with the other city sounds. The bad news is the night is quickly over. The worst news is that children are at their loudest in the morning. Of course, it's not just the mornings. It's all the time. I'm pretty confident I'll never have to tell my children to speak up. Our apartment may be small, but at least our children talk like they're on a helicopter. Maybe this is why grandparents eventually lose their hearing. It's not age. It's necessity. Why do you think grandparents love your children so much? It's because they're half deaf. I don't want to give the impression there is any consistency to the noise levels. We are talking about children, after all. There are different volumes of loud, and the kids know their cues. If you get a phone call, children intuitively know to speak louder based on the importance of the call. If you are removing a toddler from a wedding or a funeral, they will understand they are supposed to scream. This is why there's virtually no difference between carrying a 2-year-old and playing the bagpipes. You might as well be wearing a kilt. Screaming. Did I mention the screaming? Screaming is usually associated with horror films and roller coasters. This is why I usually look like I just watched a horror film on a roller coaster. Kids love to scream. Frightened, happy, bored. They scream. I've actually learned to love the sound of a vacuum cleaner. It's just so peaceful. It's amazing how you get numb to certain amounts of screaming. I've learned to focus on work with screaming in the background, like a surgeon in a MASH unit while being shelled, "Incoming!" You also learn to decipher the many types of screaming. I've had thoughts like, that's the I had too much sugar type of screaming. Oh, that's an I don't want to take a bath type of screaming. Then there's the, did someone just get their hand caught in the door? Let me get out of bed and run and find out type of screaming. There's a tipping point with screaming, where the screaming eventually becomes contagious. If one kid starts screaming, even the children that were docile or napping start screaming. I was never a screamer, but now I scream. Well, maybe I'm not screaming, but I raise my voice over really important things like washing hands. Initially, I was shocked. Wait, why am I raising my voice? Now I know. I yell because my kids don't hear me otherwise. To them, my normal voice doesn't register. They only hear, carry on, don't acknowledge I'm even talking to you, carry on. Unless, of course, I scream. If you come to visit us at our apartment building, there is no need to ask what apartment we live in. Just follow the screaming. The Chud People. Like many of us, I grew up in the type of neighborhood where you had to go outside and look in your neighbor's driveway to see if anyone was home. In New York City, if you live in an apartment building, there are likely people living beside you, below you, and above you. You can hear your neighbors leave for work and come home at night. You know their traffic patterns and when they take a shower. Sometimes you can hear when they are arguing or even when they have a cough. The unspoken New York City apartment etiquette is that neighbors should make every effort to not deliberately disturb each other or look each other in the eye. Many people in New York live above or next to a bar or a nightclub, and I am sure that this is incredibly annoying. I am also sure that the nightclub scenario would become much more attractive if one were faced with the choice between that or living in the apartment under my family. We have 5 small children climbing, jumping off furniture, throwing themselves on the floor in a fit, and for no reason at all, just tapping. Not to music, just tapping. No reason, just tapping. Tap, tap, tapping. Annoying, right? We've lived in our apartment for 6 years, and we are on our third set of downstairs neighbors. Living there presently are two brothers from Italy, who seem to be visiting the U.S. less and less since moving into the apartment. Hopefully, we are not damaging our country's relationship with Italy. We make efforts to stop our children from making noise, but it's like trying to stop the sun from coming up. We've explained to them that there are people living downstairs. We explain that our neighbors don't like the knocking and the bouncing of a basketball at 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. We have explained and explained and explained, but alas, the thumping continues. In the entire time we've lived in the apartment with our children, there was only one incident when I could even temporarily stop the incessant banging. I was telling my then 4-year-old daughter, Mari, that she couldn't jump up and down because she was disturbing the people that live below us. Suddenly she stopped and looked at me very seriously and said, "Wait, there are people living on the floor?" Thinking fast, I replied, "Of course there are people living on the floor. They are called the Chud people, and they get angry when they hear noises. Please don't wake them up, or they will climb up here and come after us." Evil? Yes. But it freaked her out and stopped the noise for at least an hour, at which point she forgot about the Chuds and resumed jumping up and down. Progress, not perfection. When the neighbors living below us inevitably decide to move out, they always make the polite request that we hide our existence from potential new tenants. We comply because we feel horrible for having had them suffer under the weight of our world for a couple of years. We agree to help them trick new neighbors into moving in below us, just like we agreed to help our former downstairs neighbors trick them into moving in below us. We are very ethical in our dishonesty. Hiding the fact that our apartment is essentially a non-movable clown car is not easy. We must remove all proof of children from the hallways. This involves taking in scooters and strollers into our already cramped apartment. We scour the halls for any telltale plastic toys or dropped goldfish cracker. We remove our children's holiday artwork from the front of our door. Our pre-Italian downstairs neighbors, Steve and Andrea, actually offered to buy us lunch so my family wouldn't even be in the building during an open house, a really kind way to say, just get the hell out of the building. I thanked them for the kind offer and instead took it upon myself to get our chaos the hell out of the building for a couple of hours. There was once a surprise visit by a very serious prospective tenant. Our neighbors called us at the last minute. We really had to scramble. It was too late to take the kids out for fear of exiting the building and running into the unsuspecting buyer with a gaggle of foot-heavy toddlers. When we heard the realtor in the hallway with a nice couple, we shooed all the kids into a back room and told them they had to play the quiet game. I forgot at the time that a 2-year-old does not understand the rules of the quiet game, or any rules of any game. I clapped a hand over her mouth, and suddenly it became the scene in The Sound of Music where the Von Trapp family is hiding in the convent from the German SS. As we continue our search for a new apartment, our must-have list does not include anything about pre-war, original moldings, or good neighborhood schools. We just need to find a place where the downstairs neighbors are deaf, or some other example of people who can't hear that is not offensive to deaf people. Either way, I just don't want those chuds to come after us. Monsters. Kids are actually afraid of monsters. I remember being afraid of monsters as a kid, but now it seems pretty absurd. My son, Jack, is a confident, outgoing 6-year-old. Yet at night, monsters are a sincere concern of his. He's not making it up to get attention. To him, it's a realistic possibility that there is a monster in the hallway, and he needs me as a security escort to go to the bathroom. He is not at all concerned about a domestic terrorist attack or an economic disaster, but he is terrified of monsters. Personally, I think the concept of an old white guy with a beard and a red coat coming down a chimney in the middle of the night, or a fairy with a tooth fetish sliding things under my pillow while I slept, would be way freakier, but no. For kids, it's monsters. Monsters are no different from fear of the dark. Why are children afraid of the dark? Because monsters live in the dark. You can tell a kid there's no such thing as monsters, and they will look at you like you are naive. Right, Dad. There are no monsters, and we didn't really go to the moon either. and they walk away from you like, don't say I didn't warn you. Where does this fear come from? It's just the fear of the unknown. They can't describe the monsters, nor can they verbalize what these monsters will do to them if they ever actually do encounter them. But they know they're out there, watching, waiting. We never really completely lose the fear. But as adults, we give the monsters different names, like bankruptcy and cancer. If our stockbrokers and doctors lived in our house, we'd be running to their room every night, too. Of course, some kids aren't afraid of monsters at all. My 3-year-old Katie wants to sleep in her bed with monster dolls and be told stories of zombies and werewolves. Maybe she is just the type of person who literally is embracing her fears. I'm not exactly sure why one kid in particular is so scared of monsters, but he's waking me up almost every night to tell me they're there. And like any good parent, I explain to him that there are no monsters, but if he doesn't get back in bed, I'm going to let the monsters in his room. Nothing in common. I'm not a man with many hobbies, besides eating, sleeping, watching an occasional football game, and of course eating. I just like spending time with my children, although I'm consistently amazed at how little I truly have in common with them. I'm comfortable with the fact that a 2-year-old doesn't really grasp the hide or the seek part of hide and seek, and I'm not expecting to watch The Wire with an 8-year-old, but I would think there would be some overlap in interests. I realize their time on this planet has been short, and sophistication is not something they can even pronounce, but I'm constantly stunned by our lack of commonalities. Nothing in my life has ever been as important as pushing the elevator button is to my 3-year-old. My 6-year-old son, Jack, actually doesn't like mashed potatoes. Yes, mashed potatoes. One of the greatest things on earth. The ice cream of potatoes. I know, I didn't think it was possible either. He, of course, loves French fries, hash browns, and baked potatoes, but mashed potatoes might as well be sewer sludge. Ew, mashed potatoes. Little kids simply have bad taste in everything. Little kids' taste in clothing is baffling. I'm not a big believer in fashion, but I know that if you ask a 3-year-old boy to pick something out to wear to the park, the outfit will definitely clash and most likely not include pants. Okay, why don't we wear pants and a shirt instead of a pair of goggles and a hat? Little kids are the only sober human beings for the past 50 years to enjoy a parade, and not for the kitsch appeal. People walking down the middle of the street to a drumbeat are fascinating to them. I always end up with the heaviest kid on my shoulders, watching the back of someone's neck get sunburned. It's no picnic. Anytime you eat outside with a kid, it's a picnic. Kids love picnics, or as I call them, eating uncomfortably on the ground while swatting flies away from your food. Little kids' taste in music is just as baffling. That Barney song, really? It's a total ripoff of a million other bad songs. And Barney gets the credit? I smell a lawsuit. My 3-year-old daughter, Katie, figured this out subconsciously because she frequently does her own mashups of these obviously plagiarized tunes. They love all these horrible songs that are often about other people's misery. Everyone knows that Ring Around the Rosie is about people dying of the plague. The Old MacDonald song is clearly about some poor farmer who lost his farm to foreclosure. He had a farm. Why doesn't he have a farm anymore? The economy. Yet little kids smile and clap as they sing it. It's just cruel. A small child's taste in movies is just as atrocious. You know you'll do anything for your kids when you find yourself paying $12 a ticket to see the Smurfs. If you like some of the movies toddlers like, you definitely keep it to yourself. I brought my kids to see Yogi Bear. At the end, my then 4-year-old son, Jack, popped out of his chair and said, "That was amazing!" I responded with the appropriate, "Shh." Save the enthusiasm for a Pixar movie. This room is filled with your peer group. Don't embarrass yourself. I was tempted to turn to the parents behind me and announce, "He's being sarcastic." Of course, I shouldn't be surprised when my children beg to watch Spy Kids 2 for the 20th time. After all, they are still impressed by the carousel, also known as a merry-go-round or a boring piece of junk. 40 years after man walked on the moon, a slowly rotating plastic statue garden will put my children in gleeful hysterics. Yay, a merry-go-round! Daddy, can we go on it? Oh, please, please! You are just going around and around at an excruciating slow pace to music they wouldn't even play in an elevator. Nothing exciting is going to happen. That's why those bogus shabby leather seatbelts are so loose. They will never have cause to need those seatbelts. At least with NASCAR, there's always the potential for an awesome wipeout. I guess I'm doomed to never have anything in common with my kids except my last name. The sad thing is by the time they're old enough to have good taste, I'll be one of those old guys with bad taste. Really, Dad? Those clothes? That music? The Smurfs movie? I finally understand what the generation gap is. Well, at least we'll always have McDonald's. Hotel New York City. We live in a 5-story walk-up. To you non-city dwellers, the term walk-up is used to describe an apartment building that is so luxurious it doesn't have an elevator. It's called a walk-up because once you get up to your place, you never want to walk down. To fully understand this quandary, imagine you are watching television without a remote control, and to change the channel, you have to walk up 5 flights of stairs carrying a stroller. My dreams often involve elevators. I should mention this apartment is on the Bowery in Manhattan. For those listeners not presently recovering from heroin addiction, who are familiar with the New York City area, consider this. Supposedly the term hobo comes from a description of the sketchy characters who were the main inhabitants on the cross streets of Houston and Bowery. Hey, that's right where I live. Isn't that cool, hip, and ironic? The tiny overcrowded apartment where I'm raising my young children is in the same location where they manufacture homeless people. Location, location, location. I truly love living in New York City, and I'm proud to call it home. New York City is a global city and exerts a significant impact upon commerce, finance, media, art, fashion, research, technology, education, and entertainment. New York is the home of the United Nations and has welcomed all kinds of different cultures, most recently the parent culture. Despite the great improvements in the quality of life over the past couple of decades, the city is still not really kid-compatible. The last several years have seen more and more parents deciding to stay in the city rather than take a long, frustrating, traffic-congested commute in for work. There have been a lot of great new playgrounds, kids' programs, and kid-themed events added to this fine city. These things, coupled with all the other assets I mentioned earlier, would make it sound like an ideal place to raise a well-rounded individual. The problem is that all these amazing places and activities that New York City has to offer are impossible to get to if you have 5 kids. We don't have a car, an SUV, an 8-passenger van, or one of those Partridge Family buses. This means our primary forms of transportation are cabs, walking, and the subway. Cabs are probably the most convenient way to get around New York. True, cabs are super expensive, but not really compared with gas and parking. Cabs give you door-to-door service, and the drivers are always great characters. Why not take cabs everywhere? Well, New York City cabs are only allowed to carry up to 4 passengers at a time. That's right. I can't fit my entire family in one cab. There goes the cab option. So walking. Walking had always been one of my favorite things about New York City. Many times on a balmy autumn evening, I would opt for walking home from a spot at a local comedy club, even if I could get home much faster on the subway. True, I am a cheap bastard, but it wasn't just because of the $2.25 that I could save. Walking for 30 minutes in the city is a completely different experience from walking for 30 minutes past a boring cornfield. There are remarkable sights, sounds, and the people watching that makes the time pass extraordinarily fast. And before you know it, you have arrived at your destination. However, when you add a couple of kids and a stroller to that equation, it becomes a vastly different experience. Strolling a kid down a sidewalk seems like it would be easy, except for the fact that the stroller is the Bermuda Triangle of kids' shoes. Strollers should always come with a coupon for a free pair of shoes. You can't stroll a kid a half a block before they only have one shoe on. You have no idea when or how they got it off, or how you missed a shoe being dropped or flung from something you are pushing right in front of you. When you have walked over it, Toddler shoes should definitely come in threes. Of course, then you would always lose the wrong one. Then there are the kids that are walking with you. Little kids have short legs and complain a lot. Also, when you walk with kids, they get bored of simply walking real quickly. Every metal grate, fire hydrant, tree guard, pole, stoop become part of his or her personal obstacle course. A simple walk becomes my personal obstacle course. But my obstacle is actually getting anywhere. Well, I try to wrangle my chimps off of dangerous death traps like tree guards, stoops, ramps, and poles, and try to prevent them from getting too close to the curb, where giant trucks and mindless cyclists are inches away from plowing them over. So the subway is a fast and economical way to get around Manhattan. But from the moment the turnstile smacks your kid in the head to the time your child terrifies you by almost falling in the gap between the platform and the train, to the lack of interest anyone has in yielding a seat to you, to the kid inevitably licking the subway pole that 800 million filthy hands have touched, to almost missing your stop because it's too crowded to get off and you don't want your kid trampled, to carrying the stroller up three flights of subway station stairs behind people who are moving so slow you have to hold yourself back from stabbing them, to the time you realize that the museum is closed for renovations, this fast, economical, environmentally friendly form of transportation becomes more of a treacherous pilgrimage than a way of getting from point A to point B. So the payoff of all these terrific playgrounds, music classes, and cultural destinations dramatically diminishes when by the time you get to them, you are a harried shadow of your former self. And instead of being enthusiastic about showing your children all the ancient artifacts in the Temple of Dendur, all you can do is feel terrorized, anticipating the dread of the return trip, and you'd pay $1 billion for some ruby slippers you could click together and magically be face first in your bed in an air-conditioned room, crying your eyes out, muttering over and over again, "There's no place like home." Raising children in New York City is just stupid. So why do we stay in New York City? Why don't we move to the suburbs or L.A. or at least get a bigger apartment? Well, I feel like I can't leave New York City. Los Angeles, I don't want to deal with the sunscreen. Plus, I can't get in that kind of shape. Besides, I love New York City. When I was 10 years old in Indiana, I remember looking around thinking, there's been an enormous mistake. I'm not supposed to be here. I belong in New York City. I need New York City's energy, diversity, and the convenience. Sometimes I leave for work 10 minutes before I have to be on stage. I don't want to give that up. I work in New York City during the day and at night. I'd be commuting constantly. Also, there is no normal in New York City. I grew up in a small town where everyone was white and Christian, and Giovanni's Italian restaurant was considered ethnic food. I want my children to be exposed to social, economic, and cultural diversity. I like it when my 5-year-old asks me if a woman in a burqa on the subway is a ninja. Jeannie and I would love to be in a bigger apartment, but we need something that would give us that last influx of cash to afford a place we really require. Something like selling a book that lots and lots of people might buy. Thank you for helping us get a bigger home. Tell your friends, I'd invite you over to the new place, but that would mean I'd have to put on pants. Vamanos. Recently on a warm, sunny day, a day perfect for napping rather than wasting outside, I found myself preparing to single-handedly take all 5 of my kids to the park. I was doing this because I'm a great father, and because Jeannie told me to do it. Now, the only thing harder than leaving Jeannie and the kids when I go out of town to do shows is getting my entire family to leave the house to do anything. It is probably easier to land a quadruple jump in ice skating than to get my 5 children to depart our house in a timely manner. Everyone knows leaving anywhere with a large group is extremely difficult. I don't know how Moses did it. Does everyone have their shoes on? I wanted to leave Egypt for the Promised Land like 2 days ago. I grew up in a big family, so I learned early on that everyone leaving the house together at the same time is virtually impossible. And I'm sure there's some law of science to explain it, whereby if one body exerts force on 5 other bodies, nobody goes anywhere. When I was growing up, my dad would just leave without us. I remember my mother saying, "Where is he? He left?" I remember thinking at the time, "Jerk." Now I get it. When you have little kids, you can't just say, come on, let's go, and walk out the door. Nor can you say, we're leaving in 5 minutes, and sit down and check email. It will immediately become apparent that even if you're taking them somewhere they want to go, your children will not move a muscle to do anything to get themselves ready. You must be an active participant in herding them out the door. If there is an electronic media device turned on anywhere in the vicinity, you must turn it off in order for your children's brain to process that you are speaking to them. Even if there were shoes lined up next to the door, at least one shoe from each pair will have mysteriously disappeared by the time they have to go on their feet. You must always add find the shoe time to your calculation of estimated time of departure. If you have a child in diapers, you must realize that they time their soiling of the diaper to the precise moment you say, okay, we are all finally ready to go. If it is winter and there are hats, gloves, scarves, and mittens involved, just forget it. You might as well just stay in. It will be the spring thaw by the time you get them bundled. It's not just leaving. It's leaving with stuff. There's just so much stuff to bring when you have young children. When you're headed to the park, you must pack diapers, wipes, juice boxes, and sunscreen. And then there's the stuff for the kids. Thank you, I'm here all book. Hey. Once you have collected all the stuff you need for the kids, you must deal with the stuff that the kids have decided that they want to bring with them. It's never the logical thing to bring to the park, like a bat or a ball. Daddy, I want to bring my Play-Doh to the park. Your departure becomes further delayed by the 20-minute debate you are forced into, where you futilely try to explain why Play-Doh, board games, and dress-up clothes are probably not appropriate things to bring outdoors. I usually compromise by allowing them to grab one toy they don't mind not returning with if it's lost or because it's Play-Doh. My one-toy policy usually backfires. For example, on this particular my wife won't let me take a nap day. Our 6-year-old, Jack, decided he was going to bring his harmonica to the park, a harmonica that his older sister Mari suddenly believed was hers. I had to then find the other harmonica so they both could lose the same thing at the park. Overhearing this conflict, 3-year-old Katie insisted that she also wanted to bring a moniker to the park. Of course, there were only 2 harmonicas, also known as monikers, so I had to convince Katie that a plastic red recorder was a fancy moniker. Mari, ever supportive, seconded my lie. When my 1-year-old Michael indicated in his unintelligible baby talk that he too wanted a moniker, I just handed him a square baby pillow that made noise and informed him it was a harmonica. He seemed satisfied, or just had gas. As long as we're on the subject of gas, little kids have no awareness of if or when they need to use the bathroom. Do you need to go to the bathroom? Do you think you may need to go to the bathroom? Why don't you just try to go to the bathroom? They never need to go to the bathroom until you get to the place without a bathroom. I've become one of those parents who demand their children go to the bathroom. But I don't have to. Well, go anyway. After everyone faked going to the potty, we were ready to go. Then Mari, being ever unsupportive, piped up, Mom says we need sunscreen. My shoulders drooped as I grabbed the sunscreen and began the arduous process of protecting my pale offspring from the evil sun. I haven't even gotten out the door yet, and I'm already exhausted. An hour later, we trekked down the 5 flights of stairs. I wore the newborn in a Bjorn, carried my 1-year-old, and held the hand of my 3-year-old while I pleaded with my 6- and 8-year-olds to hold on to the railing. At the bottom, I had the 8-year-old hold the hand of the 1-year-old as I grabbed the double stroller off the 2nd floor, where our childless neighbors had mercifully allowed us to store it with the big kid scooters. I pushed the 1-year-old and the 3-year-old in the double stroller as I wore the newborn and monitored the 6- and 8-year-olds on their scooters. I was super dad. My relief at achieving departure from my apartment, coupled with my utter exhaustion, probably came across as confidence or calmness. Strangers looked at me like I was running a mobile daycare. I proudly headed to the playground, because unfortunately for a lazy guy like me, children like dogs and need exercise and fresh air. Because we don't have a backyard, I can't just open the door and let them out. Well, I could, but I would probably get a visit from Children's Services. Children need a backyard. This statement mostly comes from friends who have moved to the suburbs in order to give their children a precious yard that they don't feel comfortable letting them play in because they've watched too much Law & Order Special Victims Unit. I get the suburban yard argument. But given that I work in the city during the day and at night, I'd rather my children know me. I realize my children are missing something by not having a yard. A couple years ago, my sister Kathy was living in a New York City suburb. We had Thanksgiving at her beautiful house with a spacious backyard. For months after that, my children kept requesting that we visit the aunt with the house in the park. New York City parks and playgrounds are really my children's backyard. Unfortunately, this means occasionally there are dead rats, homeless people, and used syringes in our backyard, but I think it gives my kids character and a strong immune system. So that's where we are headed today, our backyard, and it only took us 2 hours to get there. Going to the playground is never really a day at the park, because my children are city kids who are growing up going to playgrounds. They sometimes complain about going to the same playground. We went to that playground yesterday. So we go to many playgrounds. New York City playgrounds are usually named after great New Yorkers who nobody has ever heard of. As a parent, you end up using nicknames to describe them. There's Dirty Park, DeSalvio Playground, Injury Park, Chinatown's Columbus Park, Poser Park, Bleecker Playground, Kidnapper's Paradise, Ancient Playground, First and First, don't know actual name, Heroin Addict Park, Tompkins Square Park, and The Park, Central Park. On more than one occasion, I've made excuses for the stumbling heroin addict. Is that guy a zombie? Actually, yes, he is. It is probably unique to New York City that your children can't play in a sandbox because it's closed due to rat poop. The dynamic of New York City playgrounds are fascinating. There are typically children of every race and socioeconomic background. There are moms, dads, grandparents, and nannies. Some caretakers are on the phone, some are chatting with one another, and some are actually playing with their kids, but mostly the kids are on their own. Even though there are watchful eyes nearby, this is the place where children feel like they can run free. I love watching children socialize at the park. It is so much easier for young kids than it is for adults to make friends. The lines children use to introduce themselves with are fascinating. Do you like Star Wars? I like Star Wars. To a kid with a Cars t-shirt. I got that movie. Or just a simple, wanna play? Sometimes they won't say anything. They will just start playing with some kid they've never met. This would be the equivalent of going up to an adult that is dancing and just starting to dance with them. Yet when I tried that at the ballet, people assumed I was drunk. Granted, I was, but that's beside the point. If only all human interactions were as easy as they are for kids. Sometimes my children will meet kids at the playground that are just jerks. I realize parents are supposed to let their children find their way in the world, and this includes dealing with bullies, but I can't help myself. If I sense a kid is not being polite, I'll interject myself into this situation. What's going on here? The other kid always looks at me like, oh, he's one of the crazy adults. Once my then 3-year-old son Jack approached some 7-year-olds playing cards at the park and just watched them. One of the boys looked at my son and said, go away, you're gross. The other kids laughed. I chimed in immediately. No, you're gross. You are the grossest gross grocer in the world. The bully ran with tears in his eyes to his caregiver, who glared at me. I just smiled in victory. I realize I won't always be there to defend my children, but if I can trim some of the jerky behavior out of their life, maybe they won't do it to other kids. Of course, I'm also getting revenge for my own victimization as a child. I was always hoping some pale giant would appear and rescue me from the bullies. Now I am that pale giant. You shall call me Thor. God help you if one of your kids has to use the bathroom. Remember, they didn't have to go at home, but 5 minutes later, now they do. I've had some really difficult moments in my life, and using a New York City park bathroom with a 3-year-old is up there. New York City park bathrooms feel like a crime scene. You are always expecting to see yellow police tape and a chalk-outlined body. There's usually water running and a homeless guy giving himself a sponge bath. He always looks at you like you broke into his house. The only thing about the New York City park bathroom that is unlike a crime scene is that crime scenes will eventually be cleaned up. You may ask me why, if it is so scary and disgusting, and I'm not a serial killer, why would I use a New York City park bathroom? Why not go home or to a nearby restaurant or just buy my kid a new outfit? Anything but use a New York City park bathroom. I use it because when a 3-year-old tells you they have to use the bathroom, she does not mean in a couple of minutes. She means at that moment, actually before that moment. They always tell you at the last possible moment. I need to use the bathroom. Now? Almost done. Wet pants, a bad fall, and a temper tantrum are all signals that it is now time to leave the park. If you thought leaving your house with little kids was impossible, now there's the other crisis of returning home that must be dealt with. You could spend 10 hours at the park, and your announcement that it's time to leave will always be greeted with whines of, "Aw, man," or just 5 more minutes. Of course, little kids never want to leave anywhere. They never say, "You know, I'm tired. Let's head home." The more tired they get, the less they want to leave, and the more necessary it becomes for you to leave before the meltdowns start. To other people, you are never leaving at the correct time with your children. You're either looked at strangely for leaving early, "You're going already," or you're the irresponsible parent, "Your baby seems really tired, like he needs to go to bed." It's amazing that people with kids ever go anywhere. Suddenly, the only thing harder than leaving your house is returning to your house. Even though it's an hour before dinner, you're forced to coax them out with the promise of ice cream, the methadone of leaving the park. It works. Now to clean them up and convince them not to tell Jeannie I got them ice cream cones. They always promise to not say a word, but as we walk into the apartment, one will gleefully announce, "We had ice cream cones." "Oh, really? Did Daddy have one, too?" "Of course I didn't. No, Daddy had a hot fudge sundae." "What? I'm still going to eat dinner." Is it too soon to start dating again? I often view other parents the way I view other comedians. I have great respect for them, but I always assume they're crazy. I'm usually right. My other assumption about parents who have children who are of a similar age to mine is that we will have something in common. I'm usually wrong. How old is your kid is the how about this weather of parental playground talk. I'm at the park to spend time with my kid, not to chat with some stranger, but the casual chat becomes inevitable. Talking to a parent I don't know at the playground can be an obstacle course. I try not to be too forward or too aloof. If the stranger parent is of the opposite sex, I don't want the banter to be considered flirtatious or otherwise creepy. If the conversation gets too serious and we start talking about an election, religion, or soy milk, it can get really weird. Therefore, it always goes back to the safe option, asking the age of the stranger's child. Warning, avoid guessing at a stranger parent's child's gender. You don't want to be wrong. "How old is he?" "She's 23 years old." "Wow, lots of hair." If this awkward chat goes on too long and your kids like each other, you may get suckered into phase 2 of the interaction with the stranger parent, the awkward playdate. Given that I have enough kids for a basketball team, I rarely seek out playdates. I understand that other parents want to arrange playdates, and of course my kids love them. Playdates are great for kids, and most often incredibly uncomfortable for me, given my general dislike of human beings. Many times playdates with parents I don't know feel like I'm on a double date with my kid. My kid really likes his playdate friend and needs me as his wingman. He has set me up with someone I have no interest in hanging out with, but I'm doing him a solid. Suddenly, I've traveled back in time to when I was single and trapped in that awful double date scenario. I can always tell what my friends thought of me by the people they set me up with. "What did you think of Lisa? I'm not that desperate." For me, blind dates and first dates were nothing but awkwardness and discomfort. Playdates with a stranger parent are just deja vu. "Oh, you guys don't eat meat or food." "Yeah, I guess the park is dirty." "Tell me more about your job at the water filtration plant." I'm forced to engage in endless empty parent talk while my kids live it up. To be fair, it's usually a great opportunity to discover that the only thing that I have in common with that parent is that we have a kid the same age. Like a serial dater, I am spending time with strangers who I am not even on a first-name basis with. My phone is filled with numbers of people that I will probably never see again. And if I did, I would never know their real name. Milo's dad, Luca's mom, Silas's dad, Oliver's mom, that kid from Chelsea Piers' gay dad. Rarely do I meet a parent at a park or on a playdate that I develop a lifelong friendship with. Someone should really start an online service for playdate matchups. Parents could take a personality test to see if they are compatible with other kids' parents before letting their kids become friends with kids with boring parents. It would narrow down the list of potential playdate partners, parents, and help you avoid the inevitable walk of shame home from a horrible playdate. I would totally sign up for that service. I've got an idea. Why don't you start the business? You could call it Playdates.com or ePlaydates.com. You could make a killing. You're welcome. Again, don't tell me you don't have time. You're just sitting around here listening to this brilliant book. Me? No thanks. I got 5 kids. Plus, I don't like to work. Send me an email when you figure out your business plan. You can pay me then. I'll take 80%. All right. 79%. Hey, it's my idea. Fine. I'll see you in court. I'll be your tour guide. When you have 5 kids or even more than 1 kid, it can be difficult to give everyone the appropriate amount of attention. Therefore, I strive to get some quality one-on-one time with each of them. I'll proudly announce to Jeannie, Michael, the 1-year-old, and I are going to have some daddy and son time together this afternoon. Unfortunately, Jeannie will often say, fine, just don't take him somewhere to eat. I always think, then what am I supposed to do? I mean, we could play catch, but he's not that great at catching, so it feels more like playing throw. I'll try to convince Jeannie that taking Michael to Katz's Deli could be a memory that he cherishes. I imagine adult Michael saying, I remember when I was a kid, my dad would take me to Katz's for a pastrami sandwich. Occasionally, my dad would even let me have a bite. What a great dad I had. Yet Jeannie always insists on no food. She has this weird thing about eating large meals between meals. I know. She's total weirdo, right? She has this cockamamie notion that cured meat is not only bad for babies, but bad for everyone. I call that neglect. When you only have one of your children with you, you have many more options of places to go in New York City besides parks or playgrounds, the only logical place you can safely bring the whole group. Here are my assessments of these non-food places that are good for one-on-one bonding with a kid. Children's museums. I'm not really sure what makes a children's museum a museum. I guess the word museum. Children's museums seem more like a gathering place for toddlers to do fun activities while at the same time contracting a cold. I guess the idea is, why have my kid ruin my house when he or she can go ruin this play area someone has named a museum? Regular museums. New York has some amazing regular museums that kids seem to enjoy. There's the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Natural History, and a bunch of other ones I keep planning to take my children to. I know kids love museums because whenever I take my kids to a New York City museum, they are way too crowded with other kids. Don't ever go to a museum on a rainy Saturday. It's like when The Walking Dead took over Atlanta. All right, I love The Walking Dead. Get used to me using it as a reference. Museums are a great cultural experience, and by that I mean a great opportunity for you to repeatedly tell your children not to touch things. I find museums incredibly exhausting, and by that I mean acting like you're interested in some of those exhibits. So this is a painting by another European painter of another unattractive European from the 1700s. Fascinating. It seems like they were only painting the sad, ugly people back then. Hey, you're hard on the eyes. Why don't I paint your portrait? To make matters worse, it's hard to leave a museum, mostly because you can never find the exit. I've been in casinos that are easier to navigate. The zoo. Kids love the zoo. I've been lucky enough to take my kids to many zoos across the United States. What I've learned is that when children see animals in captivity, it makes them want ice cream. Hey, there's a monkey. Can we get ice cream? Let's see the polar bears. After that, can we get ice cream? Are you enjoying the animals? Do they have animal-shaped ice cream? Movies. My kids love going to movies, and I enjoy taking naps during those movies. Sure, I'm not thrilled to pay $12 to take a nap, yet it always seems worth it. I'm not even concerned that I'm missing the film because I know I'll have another 12 times to see it at home when my kids watch it on Netflix or force me to buy it on iTunes for $1,000. Brooklyn Bridge. The grandeur of walking across the Brooklyn Bridge is a great activity that attracts many New Yorkers and tourists. The views are amazing, and it's free. Unfortunately, little kids are not big walkers. About 1/3 of the way across, they will start complaining that they want to get off, and you will have to explain to them that this is not an attractive option. You keep them motivated by the great pizza place on the other side, but be prepared to take a $40 cab ride back to Manhattan. New York Yankees game. A dad has to take his boy to a baseball game, right? Well, I didn't want my then 3-year-old son, Jack, growing up and saying, my dad didn't even take me to a baseball game. So we went. I picked up Jack at nursery school and took the long subway ride up to Yankee Stadium. I proudly announced to Jack that we were going to the ballpark. He seemed excited. I seemed excited. We arrived early and entered the stadium. I bought him a $10 hot dog and we went to look for our seats. Suddenly, Jack belted.